He soon had his chance when Stone inadvertently let an option expire for buying more Standard Oil stock. Several weeks later, recognizing his error, Stone showed up at the Standard office and induced Flagler to extend the expiration date. Itching for a showdown, Rockefeller overrode Flagler and refused to sell Stone any more shares, prompting the irate banker to liquidate his stake in the company. Rockefeller now considered himself the equal of any Cleveland businessman and wouldn't grovel to anyone. Just as he dreamed of emancipation from his bankers, Rockefeller hoped to escape the clutches of Vanderbilt, Gould, Scott, and other railroad barons. Early on, he had demonstrated the edge possessed by large-scale shippers in haggling with railroads. Now, he went a critical step further, figuring out how to insinuate himself into the very infrastructure of the industry. Still uneasy at the specter of the oil fields drying up, the railroads shrank from investments in custom-made facilities for handling oil, worried that this specialized equipment might someday be rendered worthless. Exploiting this fear, Rockefeller worked out a clever bargain with the Erie Railroad in April 1874. The railroad would transfer control of its Weehawken, New Jersey terminal to Standard Oil if Standard met two conditions. First, it would have to outfit the rail yards with modern apparatuses that would help to expedite oil shipments to New England and the South. Second, it would have to ship 50% of its western refinery output over Erie tracks. For Rockefeller, the arrangement promised multiple advantages, for he not only received preferential rates from Erie, but could also chart the oil movements of competitors across the country. He could even block the exports of rivals' oil, an option that, having made this huge investment, he freely exercised. As he argued, "I know of no parallel case in other branches of business where the competitor felt injured because he could not use his rival's capital and facilities for his own advantage and the disadvantage of the owner of the capital and facilities." Rockefeller's logic was unimpeachable, unless one accepted the still controversial proposition that railroads were common carriers and should deal with all shippers impartially. Rockefeller was embraced no less warmly by the New York Central, which was controlled by the Vanderbilt family. Commodore Vanderbilt reportedly said that Rockefeller was the one man in America who could dictate terms to him. Meanwhile, his son, William H. Vanderbilt, discreetly purchased Standard Oil stock for his own account. It was the younger Vanderbilt who said presciently of Rockefeller in the 1870s, "He will become the richest man in the country," thus inheriting the title from his father. Standard Oil eventually became so enmeshed in the railroad business that it controlled virtually all the oil traffic that traveled over the Erie and the New York Central tracks. Standard Oil also profited immeasurably from the revolution in oil transport as barrels gave way to tank cars. As Rockefeller later testified, "We soon discovered as the business grew that the primary method of transporting oil in barrels could not last. The package often cost more than the contents, and the forests of the country were not sufficient to supply the necessary material for an extended length of time." Once again, the railroads balked at investing in rolling stock that couldn't also transport general freight, so Rockefeller stepped boldly into the breach. In 1874, Standard Oil, with that kindly solicitude for the railroad's welfare that artfully tied them up with myriad strings, began to raise tens of thousands of dollars to build oil tank cars, which they would then lease to the roads for a special mileage allowance. Decades later, Armour & Company, the Chicago butcher, mimicked the same strategy by buying up refrigerator cars. As the owner of almost all the Erie and New York Central tank cars, Standard Oil's position grew unassailable. At a moment's notice, it could crush either railroad by threatening to withdraw its tank cars. It also prodded the railroads into granting favors for tank cars not enjoyed by the small refiners who shipped by barrel. For instance, railroads levied a charge for the return of empty barrels, while tank cars traveled free on the return route from the East Coast to the Midwest refineries. Tank car clients also received the exact same leakage allowance received by barrel shippers, even though the tank cars didn't leak, which effectively allowed Standard Oil to carry 62 gallons gratis in every tank car. In this impregnable position, Rockefeller fulfilled a long-time wish and abolished forever the freight advantage of the Oil Creek refiners. In high-level talks with railway officials at Long Branch, New Jersey, and Saratoga Springs in the summer of 1874, he made them equalize rates for all refiners shipping to the East Coast. Crude oil would now effectively travel free on the 150-mile stretch between Oil Creek and Cleveland, destroying the advantage of owning a refinery in the oil fields and creating parity for Cleveland. When this shocking news surfaced in the so-called Rutter Circular of September 9, 1874, it sparked mass meetings and howls of protest along Oil Creek, where Rockefeller was universally execrated. Unlike the situation with the SIC, the railroads didn't tremble at the uproar, but reacted with cool intransigence, knowing the independent refiners were now doomed. 3 weeks passed before A.J. Cassatt of the Pennsylvania Railroad issued a curt, unrepentant letter in defense of the new uniform rates. For a long time, the independents had fought a valiantly unequal contest with Standard Oil, but now that the railroads had fallen under Standard's spell, the contest was over. Had oil been found in scattered places after the Civil War, it's unlikely that even Standard Oil could have mustered the resources to control it so thoroughly. It was the confinement of oil to a desolate corner of northwest Pennsylvania that made it susceptible to monopoly control, especially with the emergence of pipelines. Pipelines unified the Pennsylvania wells into a single network, and ultimately permitted Standard Oil to start or stop the flow of oil with the turn of a spigot. In time, they relegated collaboration with the railroads into something of a sideshow for Rockefeller. Only belatedly did Rockefeller discern the full potential of pipelines, and his entry into the business seemed somewhat of a defensive rearguard action. He knew that the railroads felt threatened by the pipelines, and for a time he thought it worthwhile to help them safeguard their interests by delaying the introduction of this new technology. Then, one of the railroads forced him to modify his plans. During the summer of 1873, he was taken aback when the Pennsylvania Railroad expanded into pipelines through an aggressive, fast freight subsidiary known as the Empire Transportation Company, which integrated two of the largest Oil Creek pipelines into its railroad network. Thus far, pipelines had only pumped oil short distances from the wellhead to the railroads, but this move presaged a time when pipelines would span great distances and supplant railroads altogether. Even worse from Rockefeller's viewpoint, Empire seemed the harbinger of a pipeline monopoly under the thumb of his rival and sometimes co-conspirator Tom Scott of the Pennsylvania Railroad. Rockefeller's paranoia was fully justified. In the perpetual game of shifting alliances, Tom Scott had made his tactical compromises with Rockefeller, but he generally feared Standard Oil and sought to shatter its refining monopoly, presumably to replace it with his own. In a deft countermove, Rockefeller called upon Daniel O'Day, one of the most colorful figures in Standard history, to lay down a pipeline system. Born in County Clare, O'Day was a profane, two-fisted Irishman who tempered ruthless tactics with wit and charm. He inspired loyalty among subordinates and wrought terror among adversaries. On his forehead, O'Day bore a scar from an old Oil Creek brawl that was a constant reminder of his bare-knuckled approach to business. In 1874, under O'Day's tutelage, Standard launched the American Transfer Company to construct a pipeline network. Jockeying for position, Rockefeller also acquired a one-third interest in Vandergrift and Foreman, controlled by Jacob J. Vandergrift, the steamboat captain who had merged his refining interests with Standard Oil. The Vandergrift pipelines formed the core of a new venture, the United Pipelines, that pretended to be free of Standard Oil control. By giving small stakes in United to William H. Vanderbilt of the New York Central and Amasa Stone of the Lakeshore, Rockefeller tightened his grip over friendly railroads. This set him up to extract maximum advantage from both the railroads and pipelines, so long as these two means of transport coexisted in the oil business. When the owners of the first pipeline systems established a pool to set rates and allocate quotas among putatively competing networks in the summer of 1874, Rockefeller's pipelines gained an impressive 36% market share. Between American Transfer and United Pipelines, Rockefeller now sat astride nearly a third of the crude oil flowing from Oil Creek wells. Henceforth, Standard's influence in petroleum transport would be no less pervasive and often more profitable than its unmatched position in refining. This power offered many temptations for abuse. An oil man could make a tremendous strike and suddenly feel fabulously rich, but if he couldn't hook up the gushing black liquid to a pipeline, it was worthless. The drillers had always credited Rockefeller with a life-and-death hold over them, and as the Standard Oil pipelines encroached upon the oil fields, snaking across the slopes of Oil Creek, that power took on a frighteningly tangible form. Chapter 10. Sphinx. In April 1874, as befitted the status of this new oil colossus, Standard Oil moved into a new four-story building that Rockefeller and Harkness had erected at 43 Euclid Avenue, east of the public square. Behind a heavy stone facade, the two Standard Oil floors were roomy and airy, drawing extra light from a skylight above the central stairway. Every morning at 9:15 sharp, Rockefeller arrived, elegantly attired, with the letter R neatly incised in his black onyx cufflinks. For someone from a frugal, rural background, he was unexpectedly fastidious. "Mr. Rockefeller came in with an air of calm dignity," recalled one clerk. "He was immaculately dressed. He looked as if he had been turned out of a bandbox. He carried an umbrella and his gloves and wore a high silk hat. He placed such faith in polished shoes that he provided, free of charge, a shoe-shining kit for each office unit. Tall and pale, with neatly trimmed reddish-gold side whiskers, he had a barber shave him each morning at the same hour. Extremely punctual for all appointments, he said, 'A man has no right to occupy another man's time unnecessarily.' In his imperturbable style, Rockefeller quietly bid his colleagues good morning, inquired after their health, then vanished into his modest office. Even within the Standard Oil Kingdom, his employees found his movements as wraith-like as his most paranoid Titusville antagonists did. As one secretary remarked, "He is sly. I never have seen him enter the building or leave it." "He's never there, and yet he's always there," echoed an associate. Rockefeller seldom granted appointments to strangers and preferred to be approached in writing. Ever alert against industrial espionage, he never wanted people to know more than was required and warned one colleague, "I would be very careful about putting someone into a position where he could learn about our business and be troublesome to us." Even close associates found him inscrutable and loath to reveal his thoughts. As one wrote, "His long silences, so that we could not locate even his objections, were sometimes baffling. Schooled in secrecy, he trained his face to be a stony mask so that when underlings brought him telegrams, they couldn't tell from his expression whether the news was favorable or not." Rockefeller equated silence with strength. Weak men had loose tongues and blabbed to reporters, while prudent businessmen kept their own counsel. Two of his most cherished maxims were, "Success comes from keeping the ears open and the mouth closed," and, "A man of words and not of deeds is like a garden full of weeds." Big Bill's deaf and dumb routine curiously prefigured his son's habit of hearing as much as possible and saying as little as possible to gain a tactical edge. When bargaining, he employed his Midwest taciturnity to effect, throwing people off stride and keeping them guessing. When angry, he tended to grow eerily quiet. He liked to tell how a blustering contractor stormed into his office and launched into a snarling tirade against him, while he sat hunched over his writing desk and didn't look up until the man had exhausted himself. Then, spinning about in his swivel chair, he looked up and coolly asked, "I didn't catch what you were saying. Would you mind repeating that?" Much of the time he was closeted in his office where he had oil prices chalked on a blackboard. He paced this Spartan office, hands laced behind his back. Periodically he emerged from his lair, mounted a high stool, and studied ledgers, scribbling calculations on pad and paper. During meetings he was a restless doodler and note-taker. Frequently he stared out the window, motionless as an idol, gazing at the sky for 15 minutes at a stretch. He once asked rhetorically, "Do not many of us who fail to achieve big things fail because we lack concentration? The art of concentrating the mind on the thing to be done at the proper time, and to the exclusion of everything else?" Rockefeller adhered to a fixed schedule, moving through the day in a frictionless manner. He never wasted time on frivolities. Even his daily breaks, the mid-morning snack of crackers and milk and the post-prandial nap, were designed to conserve energy and help him to strike an ideal balance between his physical and mental forces. As he remarked, "It is not good to keep all the forces at tension all the time." In the early days, Rockefeller knew the name and face of each employee, and occasionally perambulated about the office. He walked with a measured gait, steady as a metronome, always covering the same distance in the exact same time. He had the soundless movements and modulated voice of an undertaker. Gliding about with silent footfalls, he startled people by materializing at their desks and politely asking, in a mellow voice, to inspect their work. Since he was seldom seen, people often wondered about his whereabouts. "His was the least known face in the offices," one employee recalled 50 years later, still perplexed about Rockefeller's daily schedule. "He was reported to inhabit them 3 hours a day, but his appearances and disappearances were curtained, suggested private approaches, withdrawn stairways and corridors." As a former bookkeeper, Rockefeller devoted special attention to ledgers. One accountant recalled him stopping by his desk and saying courteously, "Permit me," then flipping quickly through his books. "Very well kept," he said. "Very, indeed." Then his eye leaped to a tiny error. "A little error here. Will you correct it?" The accountant was flabbergasted by the speed with which Rockefeller had scanned so many dense columns of figures. "And I will take my oath," he reported, "that it was the only error in the book." Everybody noted the man's preternatural calm. Though he had honed his will into a perfect instrument, he was even-tempered by nature. As he remarked, "You could do or say the most outrageous thing at this moment, and I would not show the least sign of excitement." He was always proud of the fact that he had an abnormally low pulse of 52. Many employees said he never lost his temper, raised his voice, uttered a profane or slang word, or acted discourteously. He defied many stereotypes of the overbearing tycoon and generally received excellent reviews from employees who regarded him as fair and benevolent, free of petty temper and dictatorial airs. This was nicely illustrated by an anecdote. As a fitness buff, Rockefeller placed in the accounting department a wood and rubber contrivance that he pushed and pulled for exercise. When he showed up one morning for exercise, a junior accountant didn't recognize him, called the gadget a damned nuisance, and demanded that it be carted off. "All right," said Rockefeller, and had the contraption removed. Somewhat later, to his horror, the young man realized that he had berated the chief executive, yet he never endured one word of reprimand. Rockefeller even hesitated to punish serious offenses, and instead of prosecuting the occasional embezzler, simply dismissed him. Throughout his life, Rockefeller was wounded deeply by accusations that he was a cold, malignant personality. In truth, like many retiring personalities, he provoked varied reactions in people. One cooper who sold him barrels in the early days told Ida Tarbell that Rockefeller was never a great talker, that he was not liked by his fellows, that everybody was afraid of him, and that he was solitary. But Rockefeller never turned the ferocity that he trained against rivals against his own employees, and people who worked for him usually found him a model of propriety and paternalistic concern. as one refinery worker remembered him. He always had a nod and a kind word for everybody. He never forgot anyone. We had some trying times in the business in those early years, but I've never seen Mr. Rockefeller when he was not friendly and kind and unruffled. Nothing excited him. Rockefeller's sister, Mary Ann, dismissed as an absurd canard the idea that he was a curmudgeon. John could always get along so easily with anyone, she declared. Indeed, had he not possessed some charm or at least cordiality, he could never have accomplished so much in the business world. So highly did Rockefeller value personnel that during the first years of Standard Oil, he personally attended to routine hiring matters. After conquering the other refining centers, the payroll ballooned to 3,000 people, and this became impossible. Taking for granted the growth of his empire, he hired talented people as found, not as needed. Far more than a technocrat, Rockefeller was an inspirational leader who exerted a magnetic power over workers and especially prized executives with social skills. "The ability to deal with people is as purchasable a commodity as sugar or coffee," he once said, "and I pay more for that ability than for any other under the sun." Employees were invited to send complaints or suggestions directly to him, and he always took an interest in their affairs. His correspondence is replete with inquiries about sick or retired employees. Reasonably generous in wages, salaries, and pensions, he paid somewhat above the industry average. 40 years later, a former subordinate wrote of the firm, with some exaggeration, "It has never had a strike or a dissatisfied workman, and today no business organization cares for its veterans in their old age as does the Standard Oil Company." It is important to point out that oil refining was a capital-intensive industry without the seething discontents that afflicted the coal mines or steel mills. Even in lean years, Standard Oil was flush with profits, permitting it the luxury of good intentions. One biographer has gone so far as to say of Rockefeller, "He was the best employer of his time, instituting hospitalization and retirement pensions." He was a fine boss if workers abided by his rules, but if they did something foolish, like show interest in a union, they promptly forfeited his sympathy. Rockefeller never acknowledged the legitimacy of organized labor, nor did he tolerate union organizers on the premises. He also reserved the right to pass judgment on the private lives of employees. Imposing his own prudish standards on his staff, he penalized any executive implicated in an adulterous affair and frowned on divorce. Sabbath observance was de rigueur, and if colleagues wrote to him when they should have been in church, they tended not to put the real dates on their letters. The most remarkable instance of Rockefeller participating in an associate's moral reformation occurred with John D. Archbold, the jovial young protégé whose pranks and infectious laughter so delighted Rockefeller. When Rockefeller initially entreated him to stop drinking, Archbold pretended to abide by the temperance pledge while keeping cloves in his vest pocket to mask telltale smells. By 1881, his drinking binges were too palpable and self-destructive to conceal, and he wrote a contrite letter to Rockefeller renewing his pledge. "My dear Mr. Rockefeller, any words from me seem like a mockery. I give you the promise, appreciating its solemnity and importance as I never did before. I will write you the letter every Sunday, as long as our relation gives me the privilege, or until you ask me to stop." Thereafter, every Sunday for 8 months, Archbold sent Rockefeller a letter confirming his sobriety that week, writing, for instance, "Please let this bear witness to the completion of the fifth period." Archbold made a sincere effort, but he had at least one violent relapse 4 years later and felt mortified at having let his mentor down. "I have never before known him to be so thoroughly cast down and in such abject mental misery," one Standard Oil executive told Rockefeller. "I do not think anyone can fully realize the fight he must make against this unfortunate habit, nor the really heartbroken condition he is in after it has come over him." Aware of Rockefeller's dismay, other executives tried to make it seem that Archbold had unwittingly swallowed some alcoholic medicine. His employees tended to revere Rockefeller and vied to please him. As one said, "I have never heard of his equal in getting together a lot of the very best men in one team and inspiring each man to do his best for the enterprise. He was so big, so broad, so patient. I don't believe a man like him comes to this world oftener than once in 500 or 600 years. Rockefeller worked by subtle hints, doling out praise sparingly to employees and nudging them along. At first, he tested them exhaustively, yet once he trusted them, he bestowed enormous power upon them and didn't intrude unless something radically misfired. Often the best way to develop workers, when you are sure they have character and think they have ability, is to take them to a deep place, throw them in, and make them sink or swim, he observed, recalling a method that Big Bill had used with his sons in Owasco Lake. They will not fail. To orchestrate such a gigantic operation, he had to delegate authority, and part of the Standard Oil gospel was to train your subordinate to do your job. As Rockefeller instructed a recruit, "Has anyone given you the law of these offices?" "No." "It is this. Nobody does anything if he can get anybody else to do it. As soon as you can, get someone whom you can rely on, train him in the work, sit down, cock up your heels, and think out some way for the Standard Oil to make some money." True to this policy, Rockefeller tried to extricate himself from the intricate web of administrative details and dedicate more of his time to broad policy decisions. Most of all, Rockefeller inspired subordinates with his fanatic perfectionism. He never did anything haphazardly, and wrote hundreds of thousands of business letters that were models of concision and balanced phrasing, the products of painstaking revision. Dictating letters to his secretary, he went through 5 or 6 drafts until he had eliminated every superfluous word and produced precisely the impression he desired before affixing his signature with the best penmanship at his command. As one top aide recalled, "I have seen him sign his name to hundreds of papers at a sitting. He did each signature carefully, as if this particular one was to be the only one by which he was to be remembered for all time. Each signature became in his mind a work of art." This passion for excellence originated with Rockefeller and radiated throughout the organization. The ethos of Standard Oil's operations around the world was John D. Rockefeller's personality writ large. While Rockefeller was responsible for policy questions and formulated the theoretical underpinnings of the trust, he didn't introduce many technical innovations associated with Standard Oil. Rather, he was a matchless executive, an unerring monitor of the stream of proposals channeled to him daily. He had an extraordinary reactive ability, a first-rate power of judgment when presented with options. Perhaps for this reason, he resembles modern chief executives more than he does his domineering industrial contemporaries. Given the primitive communications and record-keeping of the late 19th century, Rockefeller couldn't have managed his decentralized empire without masterfully coordinating a vast array of data. The ledger book enabled him to play the puppeteer and manipulate his empire by invisible strings. By mastering numbers, he reduced the most varied systems to a common standard, and he accepted their harsh verdicts without hesitation. "I charted my course by figures, nothing but figures," he once said. Mark Hanna disparaged Rockefeller as a kind of economic superclerk, the personification of ledger-keeping. This comment not only overlooks the far-sighted nature of Rockefeller's leadership, but discounts the importance of ledger-keeping in modern corporations. Numbers gave Rockefeller an objective yardstick to compare his far-flung operations, enabling him to cut through the false claims of subordinates. It was the way that he extended rationality from the top of his organization down to the lowest rung. Every cost in the Standard Oil universe was computed to several decimal places. Having always shown an aptitude for math, Rockefeller valued this quality in underlings. When he hired his young secretary, George D. Rogers, Rockefeller drew forth a watch to see how fast Rogers could total up a sheet of figures. At the end, Rockefeller said, "Well, you have completed it in the required time," and then promptly hired the young man, who served him ably for many years. Rogers left some interesting recollections of his boss's attention to detail and punctilious regard for money. When leaving the office one day, Rockefeller fished in his pockets and realized that he had forgotten his change purse. When he asked to borrow a nickel from Rogers, his assistant volunteered to make a gift of it, but Rockefeller protested. "No, Rogers," he said, "don't forget this transaction. This is a whole year's interest on a dollar." Rockefeller attributed much of his success to his quick head for figures. While he was negotiating to buy the long-sought million-dollar Columbia Conduit Company from Dr. David Hostetter, he purposely kept his interlocutor talking for half an hour as he computed the ways the interest could be paid. "When we ended the talk," Rockefeller said, "he agreed to the terms I offered, and I had saved $30,000 on the interest by my mental calculations that had never ceased while we were talking." This episode brought out a subtle vein of anti-Semitism that is intermittently threaded through Rockefeller's papers. Of his mathematical prowess in outwitting Dr. Hostetter, he boasted, "How well I remember when it helped me to beat a Jew." As time went on, Rockefeller had little physical contact with the actual refining, transportation, or marketing of oil, activities that unfolded in dusty outposts of the Standard Oil Kingdom, but stayed sequestered in the executive suite, concentrating on finance, personnel, administration, and general policy matters. He downplayed the significance of technical knowledge in business. "I never felt the need of scientific knowledge, have never felt it. A young man who wants to succeed in business does not require chemistry or physics. He can always hire scientists." Nevertheless, in the first years of Standard Oil, Rockefeller regularly toured his facilities and was extremely inquisitive and observant, soaking up information and assiduously quizzing plant superintendents. In his pocket, he carried a little red notebook in which he jotted suggestions for improvements and always followed up on them. He knew the terror inspired by that red book. "More than once I have gone to luncheon with a number of our heads of departments and have seen the sweat start out on the foreheads of some of them when that little red notebook was pulled out," Rockefeller admitted with relish. With a talent for seeing things anew, Rockefeller could study an operation, break it down into component parts, and devise ways to improve it. In many ways, he anticipated the efficiency studies of engineer Frederick Winslow Taylor. Regarding each plant as infinitely perfectible, he created an atmosphere of ceaseless improvement. Paradoxically, the mammoth scale of operations encouraged close attention to minute detail, for a penny saved in one place might then be multiplied a thousandfold throughout the empire. In the early 1870s, Rockefeller inspected a standard plant in New York City that filled and sealed 5-gallon tin cans of kerosene for export. After watching a machine solder caps to the cans, he asked the resident expert, "How many drops of solder do you use on each can?" 40, the man replied. "Have you ever tried 38? Rockefeller asked. "No. Would you mind having some sealed with 38 and let me know?" When 38 drops were applied, a small percentage of cans leaked, but none at 39. Hence, 39 drops of solder became the new standard instituted at all Standard Oil refineries. "That one drop of solder," said Rockefeller, still smiling in retirement, "saved $2,500 the first year. But the export business kept on increasing after that and doubled, quadrupled, became immensely greater than it was then, and the saving has gone steadily along, one drop on each can, and has amounted since to many hundreds of thousands of dollars." Rockefeller performed many similar feats, fractionally reducing the length of staves or the width of iron hoops without weakening a barrel's strength. He was never a foolish penny pincher, however. For example, he saved on repairs by insisting that Standard build only solid, substantial plants, even if that meant higher startup costs. He also tried to use all of the fractions refined from the crude oil. During its first 2 years, Standard Oil had dealt largely in kerosene and naphtha. Then in 1874, the company branched out into petroleum byproducts, selling paraffin wax for chewing gum and residual oil, tar, and asphalt for road building. Before long, the company was manufacturing lubricants for railroads and machine shops, as well as candles, dyes, paints, and industrial acids. In 1880, Standard Oil took over the Cheeseboro Manufacturing Company in New Jersey in order to strengthen its sales of petroleum jelly. Ever since his first foray into refining, Rockefeller had relied for technical advice on the ruddy Sam Andrews, who first transmitted to him the technique for cleansing crude oil with sulfuric acid. In 1874, a stiff new competitor to Andrews emerged when Ambrose McGregor was named superintendent of the Standard Oil refineries in Cleveland. Rockefeller was beginning to think Andrews a mediocre man who couldn't keep up with new developments in the field and felt threatened by the more able McGregor. A man of blinkered vision, Andrews was distressed by Rockefeller's soaring ambition, his constant borrowing and spending. The split between them worsened in August 1878 when Standard declared a 50% dividend on its stock. As Andrews later grumbled, "There was plenty of money made to throw that dividend out twice over and make a profit." Though Rockefeller tried to avert clashes with colleagues, nothing nettled him more than directors who preferred fatter dividends to earnings plowed back into the business. One day, Andrews snapped at Rockefeller, "I wish I was out of this business." Calling his bluff, Rockefeller replied, "Sam, you don't seem to have faith in the way this company is operating. What will you take for your holdings?" "I will take $1 million, Andrews shot back. "Let me have an option on it for 24 hours, said Rockefeller, "and we will discuss it tomorrow." When Andrews stopped by the next morning, Rockefeller had a check made out for $1 million. In truth, Rockefeller was petrified at the thought of Andrews's large stake being sold on the open market, which might have depressed the share price and harmed Standard Oil's credit at a time when he was borrowing heavily against those shares. At first, Andrews exulted over the sale and was convinced that he had unloaded the stock at a premium. Then Rockefeller turned around and sold the same shares to William H. Vanderbilt for a quick $300,000 profit. When Andrews loudly cried foul, Rockefeller sent an emissary to tell Andrews that he could buy back his stock at the original sale price. Embittered, Andrews spurned this fair offer and opted to keep the money. Had he kept the stock, it would have been worth $900 million by the early 1930s, by one estimate. This rash decision, motivated by pure pique and a bruised ego, kept him from becoming one of America's richest men. Irate at Andrews's behavior, Rockefeller lost whatever residual gratitude he felt for his founding partner and ridiculed his business abilities. Whenever he feuded with someone, he tended to turn that person into a reprobate, and he later said of Andrews, "He was ignorant, conceited, lost his head, governed by the same wicked sort of prejudice accompanying the egotism so characteristic of that type of ignorant Englishman." It was one of many times that Rockefeller singled out the English for special abuse. As for Andrews, he not only squandered a chance to make a colossal fortune, but later poured the money into an ugly ornate house on Euclid Avenue, where he dreamed of someday entertaining Queen Victoria, once described as the most pretentious residence ever built in Cleveland. This 5-story monstrosity, with 100 rooms and as many servants, won the well-deserved nickname of Andrews's Folly. For the rest of his life, Andrews lambasted Rockefeller in long-winded diatribes to anyone who would listen. Morris Clark probably caught the truth about Sam Andrews when he said, "Before selling, he was sore at John. After selling, he was sore at himself." Standard Oil was never kind to skeptics who doubted its bright future. Chapter 11. The Holy Family. At a time when America's brand new millionaires reveled in garish houses that paid queer homage to everything from medieval romance to the Arabian Nights, Rockefeller preferred to own raw land. In 1873, he invested in 79 scenic acres at Forest Hill, a lovely, thickly wooded spot crisscrossed by steep ravines and gullies just 4 miles east of his Euclid Avenue home. 2 years later, he assembled a team of investors who bought the land from him to construct a sanatorium that would specialize in homeopathic medicine and water cures. As part of the deal, Rockefeller and Stephen Harkness set up a short railroad to whisk people out to this suburban resort. When both ventures fell victim to the Depression of the 1870s, Rockefeller repurchased the land, now crowned with an enormous rambling building. Starting in 1877, he began to use it as a summer home, perhaps with some therapeutic intention in mind. For the previous year, doctors had diagnosed SETI as consumptive. At the doctor's urging, Rockefeller and his family vacationed in the dry, fresh air of Colorado in the summer of 1876. Perhaps he believed his wife would find relief from the lake breezes at Forest Hill. Eager to expose Rockefeller as a tasteless vulgarian, Ida Tarbell mocked the Forest Hill house as a monument of cheap ugliness, and other satirical critics rushed to pile on equally insulting epithets. This much-maligned house was, in fact, John Dee's favorite hideaway. "Oh, I like Forest Hill much better than any other home," he proclaimed. It enjoyed an excellent location, standing on the brow of a sharply sloping hill with wonderful views of Lake Erie. It reminded Rockefeller of his boyhood home in Moravia, poised above Owasco Lake. This ungainly Victorian confection was a wilderness of porches and gables, turrets and bay windows, covered with gingerbread detail. Rockefeller loved the large, spacious rooms with their unobstructed views. Fond of light and air, he stripped away the curtains and wall hangings and flooded the house with sunshine, adding a glassed-in porch. He even had a huge pipe organ installed in one parlor. Those who accurately faulted Rockefeller's taste missed a deeper point, however. At a time when moguls vied to impress people with their possessions, Rockefeller preferred comfort to refinement. His house was bare of hunting trophies, shelves of richly bound but unread books, or other signs of conspicuous consumption. Rockefeller molded his house for his own use, not to awe strangers. As he wrote of the Forest Hill fireplaces in 1877, "I have seen a good many fireplaces here, and don't think the character of our rooms will warrant going into the expenditures for fancy tiling and all that sort of thing that we find in some of the extravagant houses here. What we want is a sensible plain arrangement in keeping with our rooms." It took time for the family to adjust to Forest Hill. The house had been built as a hotel, and it showed. It had an office to the left of the front door, a dining room with small tables straight ahead, upstairs corridors lined with cubicle-sized rooms, and porches wrapped around each floor. The verandas, also decorated in resort style, were cluttered with bamboo furniture. It was perhaps this arrangement that tempted John and SETI to run Forest Hill as a paying club for friends, and they got a dozen to come and stay during the summer of 1877. This venture proved no less of a debacle than the proposed sanatorium. As club guests, many visitors expected SETI to function as their unlikely hostess. Some didn't know they were in a commercial establishment and were shocked upon returning home to receive bills for their stay. The Rockefeller children were no less bemused and disoriented as they found themselves eating in a big dining room, attended by a troop of gentlemanly black waiters. After a year, Rockefeller scrapped this misbegotten venture, fired the waiters, and began to convert the large warren of tiny upstairs rooms into suites and master bedrooms. From 1877 to 1883, the Rockefellers retained the Euclid Avenue house as their primary residence while spending summers at Forest Hill. Gradually, the stays at Forest Hill lengthened, the estate itself expanding to more than 700 acres and the number of employees eventually rising to as high as 136. After a time, the family spent only brief spring and autumn stints at Euclid Avenue. They still went there every Sunday, however, bringing in a cold lunch from Forest Hill when they attended the Euclid Avenue Baptist Church. After late 1883, when the Rockefellers moved to New York, They turned Forest Hill into their exclusive Cleveland residence, but never announced a sentimental attachment to 424 Euclid Avenue. They kept the old house in constant repair, always ready to receive family members, even though they never went there and it slowly lapsed into an honored, deserted monument to bygone days. Plans to turn it into a convalescent home for crippled children or aged couples never materialized. "It seemed too sacred for common use. We all loved it so," Seti later said. Despite its considerable distance from his office, Rockefeller, clad in goggles and duster, drove downtown each morning from Forest Hill, seated in a little two-seat Surrey behind a pair of fast-trotting horses. He was still passionate about trotting horses, and now had a dozen of them. He constructed his own half-mile racetrack at Forest Hill, shaded by maples planted by his son, and bought Welsh and Shetland ponies for each child. By the mid-1870s, he often returned home from the office for lunch, then spent the rest of the afternoon en famille, in a constant flurry of outdoor activity. He dammed a stream to make two artificial lakes, one for boating, the other for swimming, and on sultry days often swam the mile-long circuit, a straw hat perched on his head to guard his fair skin from the sun. After becoming a biking enthusiast, he smoothed out many dangerously curving paths and rewarded visitors who learned to ride with free bikes. He took unusual delight in ice skating, and frequently as many as 50 people, many of them strangers from the neighborhood, skated on the Rockefeller Pond on a frosty day. Since he wouldn't allow the pond to be flooded on the Sabbath, Rockefeller sometimes rose after midnight on a freezing Sunday night to direct the workmen in preparing for the next day's skating. Though he lacked interest in the homely interior of Forest Hill, Rockefeller spent hours daily out on the grounds. A tall, angular figure striding about and surveying the property, he planned new vistas, gravel paths, gardens, barns, and carriage houses. He created a fair-sized farm with 16 cows and thousands of chickens. Serving as his own engineer and following the natural grades, Rockefeller laid out 20 miles of roadway for horse and buggy rides through stands of aspen, beech, oak, and maple trees. Supervising 50 or 60 workmen, he developed a limestone quarry on the property to service his grandiose projects and adorned the roads with picturesque bridges over streams. To secure striking vistas, he also began to relocate large trees, and did this so expertly that they weren't damaged in transition. This constant rearrangement of his domain was more than just a matter of framing pretty views or beautifying a patch of garden. It was Rockefeller's typical way of remaking his own miniature universe and working out some vast, never-ending design. For the Rockefeller children, life at Forest Hill could seem melancholy as they drifted alone about the huge estate, cut off from worldly temptation by their parents. This mood of solitary yearning especially afflicted John Jr., who was tutored at home until age 10 and later described his boyhood self as shy, ill-adjusted, and frail. From the start, he wasn't made of his father's indestructible stuff. On January 29, 1874, in an unusual moment of tearful joy, Rockefeller arrived at the Standard Oil office and informed Henry Flagler and Oliver Payne that Seti had given birth to their first son. Dr. Myra Herrick delivered the infant in an upstairs bedroom at Euclid Avenue while Rockefeller waited expectantly across the hall. How glad all were that the baby was a boy, for there had been four girls, and that he was perfectly formed, Seti wrote. She always associated the birth of Junior, as he was known to distinguish him from John Sr., with the launch of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in Ohio. As a founding member, she had planned to aid her evangelical sisters with rousing prayers and biblical hymns in local saloons. And as she later told Junior, "I might have joined them if a wee baby boy had not claimed me." She fired him with that same crusading Christian spirit and horror of liquor. The baby boy was small and sickly, lacking his father's robust energy and reflecting his mother's more delicate constitution. For 3 years, his parents worried about his health. He had a cloistered childhood, insulated from a world that might contaminate his values. In later years, he could recall only a single male playmate from these early years, Harry Moore, the son of the Forest Hill housekeeper. I had a camera, and he and I took pictures and played together constantly. Nevertheless, Junior found oases of enchantment on the estate, and later cherished idyllic memories of summer afternoons spent rowing, swimming, and hiking. As they read aloud to one another, Junior and his sisters often lolled on a great beech tree whose limbs dipped over a creek. Even if his recollections sound highly idealized, with the shadows expunged, his boyhood letters are suffused with the warm glow of a protected childhood, secure in the love of his doting parents. Perhaps Junior's boyhood wasn't quite as lonesome as it seems from afar. Many decades later, his childhood friend Kate Strong reminisced to him, "You were quite the nicest boy that ever was in those days, so all your friends thought, affectionate, considerate, thoughtful, and full of fun, as well as wise almost beyond your years." Junior was always bathed in female love, almost suffocated by it. Just as Standard Oil workers never remembered a crossword from John Sr., so Junior couldn't cite a single instance of paternal anger. His father was patient and encouraging, if notably stingy with praise. As Junior said, his father was a beloved companion. He had a genius with children. He never told us what to do or not to do. He was one with us. In contrast to Big Bill's narcissism, John D. had an overdeveloped sense of family responsibility. John and Setti never administered corporal punishment, and they inculcated moral principles by instruction and example. Each child was taught to listen to his or her conscience as a severely infallible guide. For this boy, destined to be the world's greatest heir, money was so omnipresent as to be invisible. Something there, like air or food or any other element, he later said. Yet it was never easily attainable. As if he were a poor rural boy, he earned pocket change by mending vases and broken fountain pens or by sharpening pencils. Aware of the rich children spoiled by their parents, Senior seized every opportunity to teach his son the value of money. Once, while Rockefeller was being shaved at Forest Hill, Junior entered with a plan to give away his Sunday school money in one lump sum for a fixed period and be done with it. "Let's figure it out first," Rockefeller advised, and made Junior run through calculations that showed he would lose 11 cents interest while the Sunday school gained nothing in return. Afterward, Rockefeller told his barber, "I don't care about the boy giving his money in that way. I want him to give it. But I also want him to learn the lesson of being careful of the little things." When Rockefeller was complimented upon his son, he protested truthfully. It was his mother who developed him. Setti brought up her children in her own ascetic style and tutored them in the rites of self-abnegation. She imagined that she presided with a light touch and had no idea that she could be quite overbearing. As she remarked, "I never like to interfere with the children so long as they make happy noises." A sweet, good-natured woman, Setti nevertheless had a strong didactic side that could verge on fanaticism. As she once confessed to a neighbor, "I am so glad my son has told me what he wants for Christmas, so now it can be denied him." Dutiful, eager to please his mother, Junior absorbed the full force of her piety. "How good God is to have added to our lovely daughters our only son," Setti later wrote. "Though the youngest, he is the strongest in courage, independence, and Christian character." She hemmed him in with numerous prohibitions. He was told that square dancing was promiscuous and immoral, and by age 10 this little paragon had to sign a solemn oath that he would abstain from tobacco, profanity, and the drinking of any intoxicating beverages. Mother wasn't the only earnest female drumming him full of morality. Grandma Spellman also badgered him to attend children's temperance meetings. Thus, an extraordinary contradiction lay at the core of Junior's life. While his father was being rebuked publicly as a corporate criminal, his mother was pumping him brimful of morality and religion. Like his father, Junior developed an upside-down worldview in which the righteous Rockefeller household was always under attack by a godless, uncomprehending world. With three older sisters, John grew up in largely female surroundings as a delicate boy spared the rough play and teasing of brothers. He was feminized by the experience, wearing his sister's cast-off dresses, learning to sew and knit, and even attending cooking classes, as if he might someday have to keep house and prepare his own sandwiches. 8 years older than Junior, Bessie was warmly attentive to her brother, but inhabited a different world, and he grew up with the wilder and more willful Alta and Edith. One visitor remembered Alta as mischievous, impulsive, the ringleader of the trio, while Edith was scrutinizing, calculating, if high-spirited. Because the girls got less attention than their brother did, they probably had more freedom to rebel and explore. As Alta once teased him, "We girls often thought John should have been a girl and we the boys of the family." Despite his sex, Junior ended up as his mother's favorite because he was surely the most like her, obedient, crucified by duty, and almost too eager to please. The model child would struggle to become the model adult, with often painful consequences. Soon after the Rockefellers had moved to 424 Euclid Avenue, they were followed by the Erie Street Baptist Mission Church, soon renamed the Euclid Avenue Baptist Church, the struggling church that had exerted such a formative influence upon Rockefeller's life. As far as fashion or convenience went, it would have behooved the Rockefellers to attend the nearby St. Paul's Episcopal Church, where elegant couples stepped from Tony carriages each Sunday morning. Instead, they drove back down Euclid Avenue to a plain brownstone church with a tall, narrow steeple and a lower-middle-class congregation. As Junior said, there weren't half a dozen families that were not of limited means. Rockefeller felt no discomfort at being surrounded by humble people and valued this continuity with his roots. He needed the spiritual refreshment of the plain but emotional Baptist style of prayer, and probably also wanted to show that he wasn't being spoiled by wealth. The Euclid Avenue Baptist Church was celebrated as the Rockefeller Church, and with good reason. By the early 1880s, he was covering half its annual budget, even pledging weekly money from his children, and stipulating that the 20 cents from each child will be earned by the sweat of their brows, pulling weeds, etc. Avoiding clubs, theaters, and other such wicked haunts, Rockefeller was seen publicly only at church. A fixture in his ninth-row pew, his presence generating a growing army of oglers, curiosity seekers, feature writers, panhandlers, and idlers. He loved the bold, joyous, militant spirit of the Baptists and contributed open-handedly to their local charities. His foremost beneficiaries included the celebrated one-armed Brother J.D. Jones, who proselytized from a derelict barge moored to a Cleveland dock, the Ragged School, which taught the Bible and trade skills to vagabond teenagers, and the Cleveland Bethel Union, which preached temperance and Christianity to hard-drinking sailors, and where Rockefeller himself often stopped by at lunchtime to mingle anonymously with the seamen. Religion was a form of sustenance for Rockefeller, a necessary complement to his buttoned-up business life. Praising the ministry's role, he once said he needed good preaching to wind me up like an old clock once or twice every week. His life records no crises of faith, no agonizing skepticism toward the inherited orthodoxy of his youth. He believed that good works had to accompany faith, and even during the service his eyes darted around the room as he selected needy recipients of his charity. Taking small envelopes from his pocket, he slipped in some money, wrote the congregants' names on top, then unobtrusively pressed these gifts into their palms as they shook hands and said goodbye. He and Setti also faithfully attended Friday night prayer meetings and were said to have seldom missed a gathering when in Cleveland over a 40-year period. From 1872 until 1905, Rockefeller served as superintendent of the Sunday school, For a small portion of time, he was seconded to a poor mission school, while SETI headed the infant department. She liked to audit his classes and stare admiringly at him as he talked. He arrived early to kindle a fire, then dimmed the gas lights at the close. In autumn, in an oddly poetic touch, he gathered up bushels of leaves and distributed them to the children. Many of his talks rang variations on the commonplaces of the temperance movement. "Boys, do you know why I never became a drunkard?" Rockefeller asked, scanning the room. "Because I never took the first drink." To drive home his message, he told them not to be too free or easy or drink just to please the crowd. "Now, I can't be a good fellow," he said sarcastically. "I haven't taken my first drink yet." Each summer, he invited the Sunday school teachers to a non-alcoholic picnic at Forest Hill, which was probably the most festive day on his annual calendar. As word circulated that Rockefeller sometimes recruited Standard Oil employees from his Bible class, its size swelled enormously. He made any talk of business taboo, a lesson that one assistant superintendent, to his chagrin, belatedly learned. The man had bought oil at $1.09 a barrel and tried to solicit Rockefeller's advice about whether to sell. The reaction, recalled by one member of the class, was swift and eloquent. Mr. Rockefeller immediately changed the expression of his face. He crossed his knees and then uncrossed them. He bent his body forward and proceeded to cross his knees again. But he never said a word. The assistant superintendent grew restless and a little embarrassed. Finally, the assistant superintendent asked, "If you were me, what would you do?" Rockefeller replied, "I would do what I thought best." A fidgety silence was always Rockefeller's harshest expression of scorn. While Rockefeller resented being pumped for advice, he himself mingled business and religion and converted the church into a powerful platform for espousing capitalism. He had no interest in theological disputation or in discussing otherworldly matters. To Sunday school classes, he frequently reiterated his motto, "I believe it is a religious duty to get all the money you can, fairly and honestly, to keep all you can, and to give away all you can." When he met his secretary out riding one Sunday, he advised her to save for a rainy day. By way of apology for talking business on a Sunday, the secretary reported, he said that there was a great deal of religion in good business. The widening income inequality that accompanied industrialization didn't faze him because it formed part of the divine plan. By this stage of his career, Rockefeller's material success must have undergirded his faith. That he had earned so much surely signaled divine favor, a grace so awesome as to suggest that God had chosen him for some special mission. Or else why had he favored him with such bounty? The usual picture of the Gilded Age is that greed eroded religious values, whereas for Rockefeller, his golden heaps seemed like so many tokens of heavenly support. For John and SETI, the temperance movement gratified their Puritan itch to save the world, and their children joined a prohibition group called the Loyal Legion, which scared them with evil visions of demon rum. As a charter member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, SETI and other well-bred ladies periodically descended on a Cleveland slum known as Whiskey Hill, which was mostly populated by immigrant millhands. Around 11 a.m., they surged into the saloons, falling on their knees and praying for the sodden sinners. These militant ladies rented storefronts and set up a series of friendly inns that dispensed wholesome foods and sarsaparilla to thirsty souls drowning in drink. John was the principal donor of the main temperance outpost, Central Friendly Inn, making him an early pioneer in the settlement house movement. Sometimes he joined SETI on raids into the grog shops and never forgot how in one saloon he came upon a former classmate from E.G. Folsom's Commercial College who sat there, bloated and red-faced, doomed shortly to die from drink. SETI's parents had transferred their abolitionist ardor to the temperance cause after the Civil War. By 1870, they were living in Brooklyn, New York, where they exhibited the same fiery moralism that had distinguished their civic and religious activism in Ohio. In a division of labor, Mr. Spellman agitated to shut down the 2,500 rum shops he counted in Brooklyn, while Mrs. Spellman acted directly on drinkers through prayer and persuasion in taverns. During the post-1873 Depression, Mr. Spellman foresaw an impending Armageddon, pitting rum against temperance, Satan against Christ. He viewed hard times as the Lord's punishment for avarice, manifested by the grasping demands of both workmen and employers. As he sternly concluded, "God's method for punishing man's folly and extravagance are silent, but resistless." Mr. Spellman, who now drew a paycheck from Standard Oil in New York, couched his economic views in terms that suited his son-in-law. "The great trouble arises from extravagant management and reckless and ruinous competition on freights," he declared, tacitly endorsing monopoly. After Harvey Spellman died in 1881, his wife returned to Cleveland to live with John and her two daughters, Setty and Lute, and the combined